Okay, first I give a test. I gave the test last time too. And only one time did someone ever claim to have passed the test. That was here. Cybele's taken the test many, many times. The test is, I think I asked three questions. I asked three questions. And if you answer yes to all three questions, then you are more qualified than me. So I'll sit in the audience. And I sit in the audience often. I feel to sit here, you have to sit there. Even in New York recently, I went to one class from a good friend of mine. I learned a lot. Okay, and it illustrates a point. And actually, I was attending a class on the Yoga Sutras by one of Krishnanamacharya's closest students, studied with him for 30 years. His name is A.G. Mohan. And he asked these questions at the beginning, and I thought they were really relevant. The first question is, and it really sets the tenor of the class, you know, what this class will really be about, and I'll explain more. But the first question was, have you found what you're looking for? And you have to answer yes to all three questions. If you can answer yes to all three questions, I'll explain to you why I think you're more qualified than me. So, someone may have said that I won the lottery yesterday. I found what I'm looking for. I found the perfect mate. I got the position I wanted. So, yes, you answered yes. But the second question, is it eternal? Because if what you're looking for is not eternal, it cannot give you ultimate happiness because it's filled with duality. And what the duality means is that the as much pleasure you get from having it, that's how much pain you will get from losing it. And that's how much duality you will feel now. Can Bill Gates be happy? No, because what he has is temporary. But someone may have said, I have found yoga. I have found Krishna. I have found Jesus. So you may have said yes. But then the third question is, are you always living within it? Are you always with that thing which you have faith will give you happiness and sublimity in your life? And it's doubtful that anybody, unless they are either their feet are not touching the ground, they're crazy, or they're lying, has answered yes to the third question. Always being with that thing which you are looking for and feel can give you. So that's the purpose of yoga. That's the real purpose of yoga. It's to come to a point where you can be dwelling in the self. And the nature of the self in Sanskrit is called Sat Chit Ananda. It's eternal. It's blissful, and it's filled with knowledge. So that's actually the goal, to actually dwell within that eternal self and actually achieve. Now, yoga itself, and I'm going to discuss yoga psychology, but yoga psychology is a little bit like an oxymoron. Because what yoga is psychology. Because what is psychology? It's the study of the mind. And what is yoga? Yoga is the field of philosophy or study in India which studies the mind. There's six philosophies in Indian Indian philosophy has six schools, which are comprehensive of all philosophical conceptions. The first is Vaisheshika. Let's say that's atomism or science. Then there's Mimamsa, that's rituals. Then there is Samkhya, which is philosophical analysis. Then there's Vedanta, which is scriptural analysis. Then there is Nyaya, which is logic. And then there is Yoga, which is the study of the mind. It's self-discipline. So yoga is psychology. So, and I'm going to explain that a little bit more, how and how it works. But first, I just want to explain to you a little bit about how this topic came up. I've actually written a paper on it. I'll share with you later my website where you can get that paper. It's called Yoga Psychology. Is there therapy in the Vedas? And the way this came up is I've been a spiritual teacher and student for 42 years, actually. Longer than most of you have been living. And I have confidence in the Vedas. And what does the Vedas mean? The Vedas means knowledge. There's an understanding that as the conception is God breathes out the universes with our karma, it's a whole science, and as he breathes out the universes, then there is also with that the same breath that creates the universe. Tristan, I know you are listening very, very carefully. It's just as nice as your father is, you just wanted to be with your mother.
That's okay. Hungry.
Okay. Okay, get the concept here. As the universe is, as God breathes out, there's an objective. And the objective is, there's a theme. What is the theme? The theme is the one thing that connects everything else. If you have a book, if you have an essay, if anything is not connected to the theme, you have to get rid of it. What, every book has one theme. I've learned this also in editing. I took a course on writing. So you write, and after every paragraph you say, so what? So what? And you have to answer yourself, so what? And then you have to say how it's connected to the theme. And if it's not connected to the theme, you have to get rid of it, no matter how cute it is, no matter how charming the words are, because it won't. So the world has a theme, and the theme of the world is to awaken pure consciousness. And everything is connected to that theme. As the world comes out, and with the breathing, with the sound, let God said, let there be light, the world comes out, and there's also, with the world, there's a description of the relevance of everything, and that's called the Vedas. Vedas means knowledge. So I have this confidence being connected. Welcome. I have confidence being connected to this kind of tradition that there's all knowledge of any subject. You say the subject, knowing the Vedas, being connected with that tradition, you can say the meaning of it, the relevance, what it is, what it means, what's its use. So I have that confidence. And I've been training people spiritually. So one of my students, they took some psychological help, some kind of self-improvement course, maybe, you know, because they had some problems. And it was very effective. And they asked me the question, is there therapy in the Vedas? So my confidence was, yes, everything is there, but where is this? At the same time, I'm going to connect to it. At the same time, another thing happened. I was in a temple in India, and when I was in a temple in India, there was a kind of a saintly person, but what do you call that word if someone is always grumpy? Curmudgeon. What is it?
Curmudgeon.
What?
Curmudgeon.
Curmudgeon. He was curmudgeon. He was really a grumpy person. But on another level, spiritually, besides to say he was always doing seva, and he was famous as a cook. Now, he was from America, and he was about my age, and he was a hunchback. Now, you can imagine what growing up in America as a hunchback, the kind of things that go through your mind from the rejection, you know, of, you know, how you have to kind of, and what it does to your psyche and your mind. So I guess he had, but he somehow felt, he felt some relief and some self-esteem, some psychological basis, because he was such a great cook. But then one day he tripped and he broke his hip. And he couldn't do that anymore. And then we watched him just unwind. And then gradually he lost touch with reality, basically. He hadn't eaten. Now, it was an Indian temple. And people, what were they doing? They were going down and they were preaching to him the philosophy, transcend. I said, he knows the philosophy better than you. That's not the problem. Finally, you know, he wasn't eating, he wasn't clean, you know, like that, and I had to intervene. And I called up, actually, a friend of mine who's a PhD in psychology, who lives in Philadelphia, by the way. How do you like that? And I called him up, and he was connected with the mission I'm involved in. He called up, and he said, no. You know, they said, but he doesn't want to go for help. You know, they were giving so many reasons. And they were thinking that they can cure. So what happened was, eventually, that person intervened and told them what you do. You know, you have to say, you know, there's certain things. You have to report it to the police first and make an announcement, and then you can commit the person. And then he got a little help, a little counseling, a little medicine, and somehow or other, and really in 3 days he was better. Right? So I went to the person who is the head of that temple, right? I went to that person and I said, you know, didn't you realize he was depressed? Didn't you realize he was depressed? Now you have to understand, this person, he's maybe my age now, maybe then he was 10 years younger, maybe a little older. He was still taking care of his mother. There was so much affection with his mother. You know, and he was taking care of his mother and his sister. You know, he said, what is this depression? I heard there was something like this. But what is this depression? He said, I heard in Bollywood sometimes people get depressed. I realized he had no frame of reference for it. And why didn't he have a frame of reference for it? This is, I'll skip ahead a little bit, because there was sufficient, appropriate nurturing. This is one aspect of it. And there was so many impressions of hope within the consciousness. There was some scar, as they're called, impressions of hope, that he had no frame of reference for it. What is depression? So my understanding is that therapy in the Vedas, well, I'll read what I wrote in the introduction. Is there therapy in the Vedas? I was a bit taken aback by this inquiry from a young and dedicated yoga practitioner. He had been struggling for years with psychological problems. Although he'd embraced the traditional path of yogic transformation, he found the help he needed in a more modern self-help process based on contemporary psychology. As I thought about his inquiry, however, the answer seemed obvious. Rich in a tradition of intact family and community support, those born in traditional India did not need to rely on specialists to sort out mental afflictions caused mostly by social dysfunction. Classical Indian philosophy, especially its traditions of yoga, does, however, have detailed information on the nature of the mind. Inspired by my young friend's question and desiring to organize that information in a relevant way to help the mental challenges so many people face, I categorized the tenets of yoga psychology in 5 broad categories. So what happened is I realized that they may not have had specialists because of the nature of the society. And I realized how a proper society instills good mental health and how it impedes good mental health. But I couldn't deny that within that Vedic knowledge, especially yoga, there was profound information on how the mind works. And not only profound information how the mind works, I was convinced that because the Vedas is knowledge, that any process of psychological improvement that actually works fits in within the paradigm of the yogic descriptions of the mind. And you can actually show in this way how everything works. Now this is a broad topic. I just would like to ask, Todd, generally the class goes from what time to what time?
The class is till 8:30 tonight.
What?
Your class is till 8:30 tonight.
8:30, okay, we have quite a bit of time, okay? Okay, but still, that's not so much time. So what I'd like to do is, what I'm going to try to do is, I'm trying to figure out how to do this, and what I'd like to do is, I don't know, rather than go inside out, outside in, what I mean is, I'd like to take several categories and then show how that paradigm of the mind in the yogic philosophy deals with it. And these are what I like to do. I like to deal with how habits are formed. How good habits are formed, how bad habits are formed, and how you can, in fact, specifically in the Yoga Sutras, there's a verse after they discuss the yamas, right? And then they describe, well, what if you get thoughts against them? Instead of ahimsa, you have some hate, right? Instead of, celibacy, you have such lusty thoughts. How do you counteract the desire to be expedient and exploit and steal? All these thoughts, how do you counteract? And it actually has a specific verb. This is how you counteract negative thoughts. It's amazing. I'd also like to deal with child rearing. I joke I'm an expert on that. It is a joke in many ways. But I saw the paradigm combined with experience I've had as a teacher and with teachers, and exploring different educational systems, why one would work and another wouldn't work. I'd like to deal with that. And I'd like to explain, because the 12-step process, a little bit of that, how that actually works according to the psych. What happened with that one is, a little story is that somehow or other this guy came and he became interested in spiritual life, but he was a criminal. But he really wanted to improve himself. But he had every bad habit you can mention. But he had a sincerity to improve himself. So somehow or other, I kept on seeing him around, and he was actually a criminal. You know, and you name the bad habit he had. He was a heroin addict. He was a thug.
He was Kasuba's roommate previously. That's another story. That was 20, 30 years ago.
But he was gambling everything. And I met him at a time where he was trying to help himself, and he felt... He actually became indebted to me because I was around at that time and I was sympathetic. And then he started to explain to me the process of how he got over his addictions. So I want to explain how these things work in that way. Now, okay, but first a little background. A little background. Basically, I'm going to go through these principles. Okay, the first thing is the mind is malleable. And according to the shape of your mind, you'll have a different level of perception and contentment. The mind is constantly, the analogy is given like clay. So basically you have to understand this according to the yoga psychology, which is based on Sankhya philosophical analysis. Matter, it basically has different strands. They're called gunas. And according to the, let's put it this way, according to the mode or shape that the mind is in, according to the shape or mode the mind is, you'll have a different level of perception and contentment. And this is a very, very important point, that your level of contentment will be commensurate with your level of perception. Because when you actually can see things properly, there will be no problem. And even if you think of any psychologist or someone, what are they doing? They're getting to you, they're trying to get you to help see something for what it is rather than how you are perceiving it. That's basically any psychological system that works. It's the same thing. So the lower your perception is, the lower your contentment will be. So there's basically three modes. If you look at the mind, there's three modes. One, and they're like colors. When you have colors and you mix the colors, three colors can have unlimited. So basically there's what's called the mode of ignorance in Sanskrit, tamagun. Well, the mode of ignorance means there's no, I'm going to give a shape to it, there's no light. Right? There's no light and there's no activity. So the mind in that mode will tend towards depression. Now let's put the mind like this is passion, rajagun. Passion means intense desire. I want more. I want more. Better. More. Incredibly desires. Intense lust. Intense greed. That's activity. Intense activity. This is no. This leads to anxiety. And then there's the mode of goodness. Right? The mode of goodness is pure light, pure perception. And it has contentment and satisfaction and knowledge. So psychological health means to come to goodness. Because you're in that platform, this automatic peacefulness. So the first principle is the mind is malleable. And the second principle is there's a correlation between the mode that the mind is in and your level of contentment and happiness. Look at it another way. The mind is an instrument, like a lens. So if a lens is clean, if a lens is not distorted, if it's sattva, it means the true nature of its being, then you can perceive things in a proper way. You can actually see yourself and you can see God, and your problems are basically solved from that level. Now, what happens is, as this mind is so malleable, the third principle, and I've made these principles from studying, I've taken that knowledge, the third principle is there's different factors that influence the shape of the mind. Right? Because, and those are the environment in which you are in, the quality of the activities you do, and the proper understanding and response to the destiny that you have. So that's the third principle. The fourth principle is by understanding that and controlling the form or mode the mind takes, one could substantially influence how one feels. So I'd like to just discuss that and how that's done. We can start with the environment and the effect of the environment on the consciousness. If you understand, now this is a very, very important thing, that the mode that the mind is in, or the material composition of everything, is the same. The mind is composed, according to Vedic psychology, with the same thing that the external environment is. It's just in a more subtle form. So what happens is, the environment you are in and the mode it's in will affect the shape that the mind is in. For example, if the environment is in ignorance, it will move the mind that way. If it's in goodness, it will move the mind that way. Now, the mind is always changing by our destiny, by our karma, by so many factors. We know all of a sudden we feel lethargic, right? All of a sudden, you know, so you can affect that. So there's a correlation between the environment and the mind. A direct correlation. I'll give you an example. Everything is in these modes. For example, let's take sight, right? Cleanliness is the object of sight in the mode of goodness. So if your environment is clean, uncluttered, it will automatically move the mind to a higher level of perception and contentment. If you want to write something, you have to see things clearly. Try writing after eating a big meal, right? And then waking up, right? Try writing and take a table in a bar. Because the environment is like that, your level of perception. You know, you'll read the page and you'll try, you know, the words, they'll seem to be, you're trying to understand things, they'll seem to be moving. There's no light. Wake up. The times of the day. So, dirt, you know, and because it's sattva, it's the nature. This is how things should be. It gives you light. If you have the object of the sight, that's in ignorance. And what's ignorance? Inertia. So you don't pick up things. Right? You don't clean things. It's all inertia. Why are you not doing it? Because the mind is like this, then the environment becomes that way also. And if the environment's like that, it'll create lethargy. It'll create those the dark feelings, the inertia. It's actually another seminar I give, Environment on Consciousness, but it's just one factor. Music is in different modes. It's interesting, you know, they did an experiment in the New York Port Authority because they wanted to increase the public transportation, but people weren't taking buses into the city. And why? Because the Port Authority is where all the, I don't know what the politically correct term is, or even if there is a politically correct, or even people care, but we used to call them bums. And they'd be in the Port Authority, so they wanted to get the bums out. Because it's the mode of ignorance. And people coming don't want to have to face that. So they called the police, and the police, and dragged them out. Next day they were back there. Sometimes, so eventually what happened is someone played classical music. Music in the mode of goodness. Because when you're in this mode, that's your desire. That's why, this is so important too, that's why we have to hear good spiritual topics. You know why you have to hear good spiritual topics? Because unless you hear good ideas and think of them, you will not have good thoughts. Right? They're called aklishta vritti in Sanskrit. Thoughts that are not troublesome. You won't get those wholesome thoughts to do the things that create lucidity and clarity in your consciousness. That's why you have classes and training and read good books. To get thoughts. You have to change your desires. If you don't change your desires, you won't change your activities. You don't change your activities, you won't change your mind and the mode it's in. In the time we have, it'll be simple, you know, I'm making a simple presentation, there's complexities here, but the basis will be given. And we can ask questions at any time. I'll just want to get out the basic thing. So what happens is, I'll give you another example. There was an emperor in a dynasty in China, and he had limited military force, but he wanted to police the country. So he wanted to figure out, where should I put the military force? You know what he had to do? You know what he did? Based on the Yoga Sutras, even though he didn't know it, he sent people around to go to the different provinces were basically homogenous. You know, it wasn't such a global world like today. He listened to the type of music. And according to the music people like, he could understand their mode. And if you're in a mode of ignorance, where there's a lack of inertia and a lack of light, is also a lack of morality. That's also a symptom. If you don't see things properly, you don't do things properly. So this is just a basic thing, you know, in the environment. All the objects. Previously, in India, there was a culture called Brahminical culture where there would be a class of people whose service would simply be to cultivate that lucid mind. And you know, one of the things that they would do most was cleaning. Brahmin meant always cleaning. And cooking. Because this is an interesting thing too. The food carries the mode of the person cooking. So they would always be washing, always be cleaning. Everything was sattvic, clean. Their actions were very careful. Their whole service, let me keep the mind this way, because if I keep the mind this way, what is my service? My service is to understand knowledge and disseminate knowledge. You need that kind of mind. And when you have that kind of mind, then you can create an environment where the sounds, the sights, the smells, the feel, and what did I leave out? The sounds. They were all in modes that would affect consciousness. And the behavior would affect consciousness. What is Dharma? Let's talk about the actions now. What is Dharma? So here you have the mind. So first you concentrate on the environment of the mind. You concentrate on the environment because the mode will correlate to the mind. And you have to watch out because the mind will create the mind will create the environment. Therefore, we have to hear good things to get a better desire than this. To get a desire for this. But what is this? For discipline. For wisdom. For impressions in the consciousness that will mold the mind to a higher level of consciousness. But there are also actions. Right? And there's a whole science in Indian culture of what is the appropriate action in each circumstance. Because if you do the right thing, automatically it will create impressions in the consciousness that will help mold the mind to a higher level of a contentment and perception. So that's called Dharma. That's ultimately what Dharma is. What is Dharma? Dharma is the correct thing. Well, what is the correct thing in every circumstance? The correct thing in every circumstance is the action that will elevate the mind. And there's a whole science in it. Therefore, also in a proper culture, there's a system of mentorship. Because it's so complex. Because if you indulge without restriction, it'll bring the mind lower. And if you repress things artificially, it'll cause anger, which will also mold the mind to a lower form of consciousness. This is a science of the appropriate actions that one forms. So there's so much how that mind is malleable and how we can make choices in both the... And environment is very powerful. Paramahamsa Yogananda said that environment is more powerful than self-will. That to create discipline, the environment is so important. The time of day is so important. In Indian culture, the day is divided into 36, 48 periods. And they know what influence every part of the day has on the consciousness. And the most powerful influence on the consciousness, the most powerful influence on the consciousness is the early morning hours. The early morning hours are in sattva. The activity hasn't moved. The immorality hasn't moved. It's sattva. So if you wake up and you spend time in the morning, right, automatically you'll be able to see things in a purer way. Your mind will be more peaceful automatically because of the morning. The time of the day has an effect on consciousness. That's why meditation and study is always so much more effective. It never ceases to amaze me. Right now I'm preparing a 12-hour seminar, the Yoga Sutras, which I'll give in the New York City this weekend. And it's not a text. I've studied it, but it's not a text that I've extensively studied. And to teach it for 12 hours, I have to, in a certain level, master it. Right? Reading in the morning will be 10 times more efficient than reading in the middle of the day, practically. because it's so impacted with clarity. And you can see, and you're happier. You're happier in that way. So this is the basic thing. Now, I also want to talk about, now let's go into those basic things and just discuss them. Let me just read something right now from this paper. I think you'll find it interesting. This is about I'll do it in a way. I want to discuss something called samskaras. The mind is composed of various impressions. And according to those impressions, it will affect the shape that the mind is in. Right? So basically it works something like this, how your mind is actually formed. It's very interesting. When you grow up, basically your mind has attachments and aversions. That's what your mind, they're called samskaras. So basically what happens when you grow up, you get various types of happiness and distress, right? And they can create impressions in the mind. For example, let's say you grow up when you're young and your father is, you know, in a drinking culture, right? And you kind of respect your father, you know, maybe whatever it is, football or NASCAR or whatever. And you respect your father, and then when you're young, he gives you some alcohol, right? And you not only get high from it, even though you don't really like the taste, by God's grace, I never liked the taste of alcohol. But, so what happens is, it creates an impression in the consciousness, right? It creates an impression in the consciousness. What? I enjoyed this, right? Now there's an impression in the consciousness, I enjoyed this, that wants to be filled always with the same thing that caused it. Now here's the problem. We can get, if we don't have the proper child, and we don't, I doubt anybody else here is, because we're not growing up in a culture of knowledge that has a, what is culture? Culture is how the environment is formed to give favorable impressions in the consciousness. In Sanskrit, it's called aklishtavritti and klishtavritti. Klishtavritti are attachments we have for things that are not good for us. Right? Because you can get a sensual pleasure that's temporary, but is very bad for the mode or form of the mind. We see that all the time, right? People, the classic one is heroin. Wow, I love that. That's great. So you get the sensual pleasure, but because it's so much in the mode of ignorance, it moves you to a level of depression or alcohol. See, when you're young, so you get these impressions, right? So what happens is, okay, now you like alcohol, right? So what happens is, whenever you're in the proximity of that object, you're near a bar, you're at a party, etc., it creates an impression, right? You want that. Or they can create an aversion. So here you have, I like something that's good, but here's something else. You grow up and your father is very respectable, and he has high moral character, and he always tells the truth, and he reads from you every day the Mahabharata, the great stories of the people who make vows and are true and good, and George Washington and the cherry tree and the everything. So you get this. What is it? Truth is good. I always want to tell truth. Right? And then you may see, maybe your father is, or your mother is like disciplined, self-sacrificing. So you develop what's called a a klishta vritti, an impression in the consciousness for things that are good for you, that are in the mode of goodness. Right? So here's your mind. Right? And then you can have impressions for things that, here you are, you grow up, and somehow or other, there's problems with the father, and you're a young girl. Now what happens is, then you get the impression that, or let's have another, let's take it another way. You grow up, and the parents are dysfunctional, so what you do is you don't like authority. Right? I don't like authority. I don't like anybody. But if you have a father and a mother that's respectable, you develop respect for authority. So now you come in a spiritual process where that kind of connection with the teacher is necessary, and you'll have an impression, I don't like it. You don't like what's good. So your mind is composed of all these impressions. And hopefully you like the things that are good, and therefore you'll always be seeking them. You don't like the things that are bad. Right? You have an impression, again, you're trained in something. You get some scars. And your parents are extremely spiritual, right? And therefore, you don't like to lie, right? So you have these impressions. I like what's good. I don't like what's bad. I like what's bad. I don't like what's good. How difficult it is in spiritual life when you don't like what's good. It's good for you to sit. It's good for you to meditate. It's good for you to perform some austerity. In the Yoga Sutras, in the Kriya Yoga, which is the fundamental basis of purifying the consciousness, tapa is one of the things. To live simply. Right? But you may grow up in a culture where there's so much advertising that's telling you more and better and so many things. And you get so many desires. And who are your exemplars? And they're being promoted to you. So you want anything. Power is good. Right? Unrestricted sex life is good. So many things. These are the goals. The things that are not molding your life to a higher level of consciousness. So that's what your mind is composed of. And yoga says, well, here's one thing it says, one practice that you can do, and actually how you change this, is if you have a bad thought and you have the understanding, like for example, what's the first yama in yoga? First yama in yoga is ahimsa. Right? Okay, but now here's a person, and here's the impression you have, right? You have hate for that person. Now hate is going to degrade your mind. Right? Because it's the mode of ignorance. So you have hate. So it says, you can cultivate the opposite samskara, right? What you can do is, look, you hate that person, you can do two things. You can meditate consciously on the person's good qualities. Create another samskara. I like this person, and why? Or you can create a samskara of hating hate. This is the result of hate. This destroys my yoga. This is against the principles. You can create counteracting. Or if you have a bad habit and you hear enough, you can think of what the result of that will be. Right? So you create, as you have a like for it, you create a samskara. Now, I'm going to do something now. It's kind of an experiment, and I even went to, and I'm going to show you now how habits are created. Now, I hope this works. I can't say it will. But okay, here's the mind, okay? You ready? Here's the mind. Okay? Let's take, I'm going to show you how addiction is formed, all right? Okay, you like prajalpa. Prajalpa in Sanskrit is frivolous talk, right? Now, a cultured person, he's very careful with his language and words. He wants it to be in the proper mode, right? He just doesn't talk frivolously because, again, it may be in the passion, it may be ignorance, okay? So here it is. This is how you become addicted, right? A computer comes out, and all of a sudden there's Facebook. And you go, wow, this is great. Why is it great? Because I can't have idle talk. And if there's nothing I like in my bored life, it's to have idle talk, right? So here it is. You enjoyed it, right? And it created impression for idle talk. Okay? You see that? Now, you go to the computer again, right? And, you know, you're sitting, you're supposed to be meditating, but the computer goes on and you hear the, like a message has come for you. Thank God no one's in the class now. When Facebook first came out, I'd give classes and people were like this the whole time. So, okay, you ready? So you got, this is for idle talk. Now this is the computer. Wow. I like it. Right? Now what happens? You have two. The force is greater. Now you go in the next day and you're meditating, or you're supposed to be at work. Wow. Idle talk. Now you have another one. Now it's more powerful, right? And before you know it, the impressions become so powerful that your mind is just filled with all these impressions and it's so powerful, right? Now, I'm going to have to explain something. This class is a real experiment to me, so I want to show you something. I'm going to want to teach you how habits are formed, but understand there are three divisions of the mind. I don't want to give too much information, but basically the mind, which is called the chitta, and just look at even how yoga works, okay? Here's the mind. It's like a lens. It's like an old television with static. You can't see through the lens. Why? Because so many selfish thoughts are coming out, right? So what does yoga do? This gets to the, it's really powerful. You focus on one thought, it quells the other thoughts, right? And the mind morphs to a higher level. Even if we did some breathing exercise now, some chanting, some meditation, in a very short time, you can bring the mind to a higher level of perception just by focusing on one thing and meditating on one thing. Now, this mind has three divisions. Very important. It's very simple. It has the manas. Manas means mind, but it means the function of the mind that categorizes things and ascribes feelings to it. This is a man. From your previous experience of it, I don't like men. Now, it may be a good man, but you have the impression the man caused pain, so every time you see a man, you see pain. But what happens is, it's a good man that comes. Now you're not seeing properly, you're seeing irrationally. Because anyway, we're like that. From our experiences, we identify something and we categorize it as good or bad. We may categorize good things as bad, we may categorize bad things as good. And you have to change it. So how do you change it? There's another function of the mind, and that's called the buddhi. The buddhi makes judgment based on knowledge. Right? So when we hear instructions, right? Here we have all these impressions here, right? Let's say, let's just use the computer example, right? And you're kind of realizing, wow, I'm wasting my life. It's not helping me. It's making my mind frivolous. But I'm just continually creating impressions. And now I have an addiction. Even at a time where I must study, I must be with my family, and I know it. It's just too powerful and it overcomes me every time. Right? Okay, now what happens is, perhaps, and generally what happens is, this starts to cause a little suffering. Right? So you're starting to get maybe a few other impressions. Let's put it this way. You get a few other impressions that have different... Let's say that it's bad. Okay, you're starting to get a few because you're suffering. But you still can't control yourself. And these are all the impressions that it's so good. It'll give me pleasure. You have the wrong faith. What does faith? Faith means, to trust in something sublime. If you have the faith in the wrong thing, then your life is not good. Right? We have faith. Wow, Facebook, it will be sublime. Right? But it's actually something that's klishta vritti. It's thoughts that degrade the mind. Okay, so anyway, what happens is due to experience, you start practicing yoga, you start getting discipline, you start hearing good classes, right? And it's starting to create impressions in the consciousness to counter it. It's not good. It's causing suffering. It's ruining my life, right? So what will happen now is here will come the Facebook, right? Right? And the mind is kind of saying, this will give pleasure. It will, it will, it will. And then maybe there's a few here that are starting to tell from the instructions you receive, from the classes you receive. It says, no, it won't. It won't. It's ruining your life. Look what's happened. You know, you're not succeeding in your career. You're not writing the books you want. You're not disciplined. What if you actually control this? What would your life be like in 5 years if you actually used this time in the right way? And you're struggling, but somehow or other, by the inspiration, and it could be that a very powerful spiritual sadhu comes and creates in your consciousness another impression, and a big one, that sublimity in life is to serve God, to realize God, to understand the soul. And it's a big impression, and you want to please this person, and you want to follow this person. And he's telling you, this frivolous life is not helping you. So what will happen is, the impression of Facebook will come, right? And instead of identifying it with the mind, which says, this is an object of pleasure, instead of doing that, you'll digest it with the intelligence, judgment. No, I should have discipline in life. I shouldn't do this frivolously. It may have a use, but not during my morning sadhana, not during my midday meal, not during my after. And then what will happen is you will resist filling the hole that is created with the object of your desire. You know what will happen? The hole will clear up. Now you have less of an inclination, less of a power. Okay? And then the next time, still by your good, you'll resist. And you know what will happen also? When you resist, which is discipline, which is knowledge, it's goodness. So as you're resisting, you're also getting pleasure. Because when you discipline yourself, the mind is has a higher level of contentment. So now you're developing impressions that I get pleasure from not doing it. And you're developing aklishta vrittis. Now, I'm going to show this to you in a very, very practical way. Okay? Can you hand these out? People can choose whatever color they want, and they can put it on their right hand. Okay? Do it in a way we can do it fast. Maybe another person can help. Just pass them around. Okay? Everyone can get one. And I'm going to show you exactly how the mind works. Okay? Okay, I'm going to show you exactly how this works, okay? And you can keep these. Okay? One of the worst things for your consciousness is to criticize others out of some maliciousness. Most of our criticism is, right? Most of our criticism is to criticize other people. You can criticize someone and say, please, that's not clean or something like that. But most of it is idle talk. So, in spiritual life, when that envy in the heart comes out in words, when that hate comes out in words, then, you know, the not wanting well for others, talking about people, when that comes out of the thing, it degrades the consciousness. It's one of the main things that actually degrades the consciousness and moves it to a lower level of perception. Here's a simple thing. So a friend of mine studied this thing called a complaint-free world. This guy, a Christian preacher, had this. So I'll show you exactly how it works, and you can try it, right? And I'll try it with you. It's very difficult. Okay? You keep this on your right hand and you make a vow, I will not criticize others. Okay? Now what will happen is, it's a very interesting thing. When you stop, you'll see how much you do. What it means is, somehow or other, in our material consciousness, look at my little thing here. Okay, we'll start another section here. These are all things, the pleasure you get from saying, you know what he did? You know what he did? I can't stand, you know. The pleasure we get from that, but it's klishta vritti. It's a pleasure that we get that molds the mind to a lower level of perception. Right? This is very powerful. So what happens is, and I'm going to show you how it works. We'll start with a fresh. So we have the mind like this, right? So what happens is, something's going to happen. You don't like someone. You're envious of someone. You're just, and you want to say bad. So what is it? One of your samskaras, impressions for the enjoyment of criticism manifests. Okay? So here's how it works, right? If you can keep this on your wrist for 3 weeks, you will be able to give up the habit of criticizing others. It will change your life profoundly. Because what happens is, if you criticize someone, you have to take it off your wrist and put it on the other wrist. Now, when you put it on the other wrist, you have to start over again. Okay? So I'm going to show you what happens. Okay? Now, what happens is, I fixed it now in the Buddha. I don't want to act by my nature I want to act by my judgment. And that's why we study. That's why we get association with saintly people, with teachers, with knowledge. Because we're trying to build up our intelligence that it should be able to digest things and put the impressions in the consciousness in the right way. When criticism comes up and the person is there and the object of our consciousness that we are envious of or we hate or we don't like or we just have the desire to be better than others, it's very powerful. So when that comes before us, right, if we don't criticize, right, because we take things to the... this, what does this do? This says, don't do it. Go to the booty. Go to the judgment rather than the impulse. Look at the things through the intelligence. The intelligence has already decided this is not good to criticize. So you're about to criticize, right? You're about to respond. Now, if you respond from here, the criticism, what will happen is you'll create another one. And you'll have even more impetus. Okay, but now what happens is that you come to the Buddha, you make your judgment, then what will happen is it'll close up. Right? And if you can do that for 3 weeks, what will happen is all the klishta vrittis, the pleasure you get from the unspiritual, hateful activity of criticizing others, will start to close up, and the impressions, I don't know how to make this in, but the impressions of the aklishta vrittis, the good thoughts that it's not good to criticize. Because when you don't do something that's wrong, you feel much better. And you'll create impressions on that. Anybody like to try it? It's so tough. Because I'll tell you what happened. In the month of October in India, I generally spend time in this holy place by this sacred mountain, and you make a vow for a month. So I usually make a vow to meditate, like 6-8 hours a day. And because I'm always traveling and so many things, I said, 1 month for myself, just to... We'll talk about this too, spiritual practice and the power that that has. So what happens is, I went and I saw one of my friends who's very, very busy doing so many things. And he said, what vow will you make? Right? And what you can do is the last 5 days you can make a special vow. So I said, what vow will you do? He said, I vow to not criticize others. It's great, I'll also do it. And if I criticize others, Indians do this, I don't know why, but if they say something wrong, they cross their hands, grab their ears, and bite their tongue. Right? So yeah, I'll do it. My God, when I tried to give it up, I couldn't believe how much I was doing it, what a struggle it was. Right? But it's just a simple thing. It's just a simple thing. But knowing how the mind works, you can do it. I have books here on japa meditation if anybody wants, where in the end of the book, I actually list the whole system of how to create the habit of japa meditation. It's amazing. How you first spend time fixing up the buddhi, the intelligence, the understanding of what your objective is. right? And then you make vows and commitments. It's very, very powerful. So this is basically how the mind works. Now, now I'll say something. Any questions so far? Yes.
These don't have to be voice criticisms or judgments. These are just thoughts.
Thoughts. When thoughts come up, it'll just show. What?
That's much harder.
What?
It's not just things you say. It's thoughts.
Thoughts.
Oh, okay.
Oh no! Say.
No, say.
Yeah, okay. Say. That's too much. No, when you say. When you say it, it prevents you from saying it, not the thoughts.
Okay.
In this age, it says we're so fallen that we don't get we don't suffer for the thoughts, only the actions.
Okay.
And we get credit for the thoughts if they're good. So if you can control it, you just see it's amazing. I mean, and if you can do this one thing, if you But it just shows you how the mind works. Why does a mother have to be so protective of a child? Because the child, I'll show you this, how this works. First, I'm going to purify the mind. After 3 weeks, I didn't criticize anyone, and the mind is pure. Okay, but there's also the... So what happens is, why in this paradigm, okay, here's the buddhi, the judgment, and here's the mind. Because look, something heavy happens to someone, right? Right? Let's say a person older treats them badly, right? Now for the child, he'll just create this samskara of, I don't like, you know, I'm a fearful of people, right? So now he's seeing the world in a distorted way, right? Let's say a child. Now, if an adult, someone treats them badly, right? But they have buddhi, intelligence. It does. It may not be, I hate. You know, I hate men, right? Let's say a lady and she's treated badly by a man. I hate men. But now let's say when you're older and your intelligence is fixed up, so you'll be mistreated, but before the impression comes in the consciousness, I hate men, you digest it with the intelligence. Well, that was a man, that person himself has problems. You know? You know what I'm saying? That is my karma. I must, in a previous life, and therefore, what you put in a good impression, right? That, you know, I should be more compassionate, right? But a child doesn't have the buddhi. They can't digest anything. So if they're not protected, the mind, and we see this, right? With a young child that's mistreated, and how then when they get older, they have so many fears, so many phobias. Right? Why? Because they couldn't digest things properly. Well, how does someone get screwed up? Well, two things: they have they're not in an environment that creates good samskaras. Sometimes in India, they talk about a child having good samskaras, good impressions. You know, in India, for a little child, they have ceremonies. The first ceremony is the grain ceremony. Sometimes a child eats grains when he's six. And they put out, it's called a samskara, they put out books and they put out money. And they put the little baby there and see which they choose. And if he chooses the books, he's more brahminical. If he chooses the money, he'll, you know, things like that. But besides that, what happens is the community is out there and it creates a samskara a lot. There are, I'm not in the world alone. You know, I have love from my elders. All good samskaras. People like me. What are their impressions? There's expectations for me. So they actually have ritualistic performances, or called samskaras, to create good impressions. To create good impressions in one. So it's a very, very interesting science how that actually does. Now, for a young child, and this is something I saw because, you know, I'm a monk, so I actually never got married. It was my choice. I had that samskara. Maybe there's also carrying from the previous life. You know, so maybe those desires weren't that strong and my intelligence was such that I could live amongst life. It's not required for spiritual life. It's my proclivity. But you know, at a particular time, I was living in an ashram, and then I had started my own community, kind of, with a lot of married people. And I had this place, and then they were all around me, and there was a school. So what I found out is what it really, I kind of watched, wow, that's what it takes to be a mother. And then I saw them train the children, and I started to talk to the people who were the teachers, and I put this information together, and I just thought, like, what creates a good mind for a child? Sufficient nurturing, right? Sufficient nurturing. Why? Because nurturing creates all these impressions in the consciousness of hope, right? I'm loved. I'm loved. I'm loved. I'm loved. And then what happens? When there is negativity and reverse, they draw on these impressions of hope. Right? But if there's not sufficient nurturing, right, and there's not sufficient hope in the consciousness, then when reverses come, they can set negative patterns of thought. And what does also the child need? The child needs sufficient boundaries. That's basically the mother and the father are the protective influence. And what does boundaries mean? Let me read it, because I think I wrote it very nicely. I think you'll find this interesting. Stable parents who affectionately monitor their child to protect him and her from such stirring events, I'll read, are formative years where the intelligence is underdeveloped, especially fashions the basis of one's mental health. Buddhi or intelligence functions as a medium between the information coming through the senses and the final impression such data will leave on the mind. Right? You get so much information through the senses, what impression will make? Well, Buddhi functions to leave the final impression and a healthy impression. If you have the good intelligence and you look at something, no matter what happens to you, you'll have a good impression. Right? But if there's no intelligence, it can leave an irrational impression. Men are bad. Women are bad. You know, I'm afraid to go outside. I don't have, you know, whatever it is. So it says, in other words, the intelligence functions to translate our experiences in a reasonable way before they make unhealthy and impulsive impressions. A child is thus especially susceptible to distorted impressions and even trauma because of this inability to digest his or her experiences by proper analysis into reasonable memories. Child doesn't have that. What does the parents do? Basically, really, what a parent does is the child, the most important thing for a child is to learn obedience to the parents. Why? Because the parents serve as their intelligence. The child doesn't have intelligence. So if the child in a proper culture learns by the parents who are worthy, proper obedience, then the parents can determine the impressions. the same time, the parents can train up the buddhi or the intelligence and gradually transfer the own obedience to them, to the intelligence. As the child gets older, then the child gets increasingly more freedom as his intelligence is developed and he has obedience towards the intelligence. Now here, stable parents who affectionately monitor their child to protect him or her from such stirring events and who deal properly with them instill good samskaras in the child. Good samskaras mean impressions that reflect the true nature of things and produce thoughts that help one grow. Such parents especially provide a nurturing environment. Deep impressions of affection in the mind enable one to see the world with promise and to feel secure even in challenging circumstances. Bereft of such memories, one is prone to depression. And that's why, I mean, the world doesn't have functional culture anymore. It doesn't have tradition. It doesn't have values passed down. A child also needs reasonable boundaries set by the parents. Without a relatively fixed world set by the protective figure, the child lives in a world of flux determined by his whims and demands. As a result, impressions of anxiousness are embedded in the child's mind, making him susceptible to anxiety as he grows up to face a world of challenge and strain. In other words, if the parents don't set reasonable boundaries, what does it mean? Every day the world is different. I want 6 ice cream cones, I want 2 ice cream cones. And then I get no ice cream cones. The best parents I've seen, amazing people. Kasturba, you know Kasturba. Some of you know Kasturba. His guru had a younger brother who's a professor. And he's the softest man in the world. So we're very close. So they come to Vrindavan for 6 months on a sabbatical. And they say, Marge, we want to take you to the MVT for lunch. And that's the days when it was really at the best. So they take me. So they have a little daughter. She's brilliant. She was only 6 at the time. And she looked at me and said, Maharaj, would you like some ice cream for dessert? I said, well, sure. And the parents laughed. They said, why are you laughing? Because she knows in our family you only get rice cream on Sunday. The world was not determined by her. They grow up secure. Although parents are the most important factor in the development of strong mind. Thus, a culture that is not structured to facilitate appropriating, nurturing, and reasonable boundaries molded by strong traditions of child rearing and community support will produce in various degrees mental instability, even if it not at the level of trauma. Although the foundations of mental health are set in the formative years, it is important to remember that the mind is malleable. With the proper process of transformation, mental health can be attained at any stage of life. So it's just this paradigm of how the mind works and how you make it healthy. What does a counselor really do? They're dealing with the impulses and trying to give people training. There we go. They're trying to give people training to be able to digest things properly and see things properly so they don't create bad impressions. Now, we'll go about 10 more minutes, if that's okay. Because I think Tuesday night, 2 hours may be a lot, but we'll see. If I really get any questions... Main realization I get is how much information is in these Indian philosophical traditions. That's the main thing. And really, I'll talk a little bit about spiritual life. What spiritual life is, really, on one level, what spiritual life And what's called sadhana or practice in a proper culture, people deal exclusively at some part of the day with purifying the mind by meditation. And it's so powerful. It changes your whole day. Why? Because what enables you to stay at the platform of judgment rather than impulse is the mold of the mind. The more the mind is in goodness, the greater your free will is. I'll give you an example. You're in ignorance, right? You just crashed out, right? Then you get up and someone steps on your toe and you're like... There's no distance between what happens to you and how you react. You just spent 2 hours meditating in the morning. The same thing happens, right? What do? There's a distance between what happens to you and how you react. Because you're more in the mode of goodness. You sacrifice your free will when you fall to ignorance. You elevate your free will when you come to goodness. So if you actually meditate, right? If you actually meditate for a substantial period of time, which means what? Is you focus on one thing. I can't go into it, it's another class, but I'm studying this intensively. Most yogis meditate on God. And God has two manifestations, vachya and vachika. What is expressed and the expressor of that. Sound and form. So it's recommended you meditate on God in vachika, in sound. You meditate on God in sound. So that's mantras. Most people meditate on mantras. There's many reasons why, but whatever the case is, and the whole yogic system is meant for this meditation by purifying the body, purifying the mind, purifying your habits, purifying your life. It's all coming to goodness. It's all bringing your consciousness to goodness. So you have greater free will. So here's what you do. You meditate on one thing. And by meditating on one thing, it quells Rajas and Tamas. All these thoughts are passion and ignorance. They're the things that degrade your mind. So when you meditate, it molds your mind. And if you meditate in the morning, then you go out in the day with a higher level of perception, contentment, and self-control. And what does self-control mean? You don't act impulsively to fulfill the klishta samskaras, the thoughts that are selfish and exploitive, that degrade the mind, because you have more goodness. You have more clarity. You have more discipline. So it's very important to practice. Now, I'm going to just say two more things. I just want to say something about the 12-step program that my friend, he was... I'll tell you how bad this person was. And I have to say, by spiritual life, he's less bad. You know, when he didn't come to one of my programs, right, on Sunday, you know, I didn't know what his job was. His job was he would collect money for the mafia. You know what they do? They break the knuckles. So they say, "Where were you?" He said, "I'm sorry, I was working today." But, you know, by this thing, so how does it work? Why does it work so powerfully, that process? And I read a little bit when he gave me the books, And actually, Carl Jung wasn't able to help someone overcome their habit. Right? They weren't able to... He wasn't. He just told someone, I think, is, you know, just like approach God, worship God. Right? So somehow, I don't even remember all the steps, but I thought about it. Well, why does it work so powerfully when so many other things don't work? And this is the reason why. And then we get to bhakti. And this is the reason why it works so powerfully. You know, I'm looking at the clock because I'm just saying, I'm going to speak 12 hours on the weekend on the Yoga Sutras. What, it's like a marathon. Am I going to be able to do this? I'm really preparing for it. But this is what happens. Basically, most addictions or most bad habits are because we're not feeling satisfied. And we have some holes. And there are many, many reasons. It's even our karma from previous life. We have some scars. Whatever the case is, we're feeling a lack or want of something. We want something. We want to be filled with something. But the thing is, we're not really sure what it is. So we say, okay, let me do it with this pleasure or that pleasure or this pleasure or that pleasure. And we get the temporary relief until we have all these other things for maybe, let's say, alcohol. You know. But what is the actual things that need to be fulfilled? It's love, actually speaking. We have impressions and desires for love that are not being satisfied. So what happens? What is the first step? The first step is what? I am powerless. Right? Is that it? I am powerless. So what that is, that's an expression of humility. The second thing is, you know, there's a power greater than ourselves. That's an expression of humility. So what happens is, this is a very thing, humility allows us to experience love. There is love, there is mercy, but mercy is what comes from above. Mercy cannot be experienced without humility. Just like a child. If a child is spoiled, the parents can give the child the world, but the child will not feel love. So it prevents us from experiencing love to the fullest degree from God, from the divine, is humility. So when one reaches the pits and will embrace this thing that I am powerless, and then approaches a power higher than oneself, one begins to experience a certain type of love that gives them the hope and power to not seek to fill one's consciousness with other things that are difficult. Really. Because we're always seeking to fulfill. There's something wanting. There's some great need. But when it's actually, if one can experience love by coming to a platform of humility. Of course, the other steps are also ingenious. I forgot them. But the support and all the things and how to do it. But the main thing, it gives you an ability to experience love by humility. And that's what we're seeking. And when our hearts are filled with that, then we can have the power to control other things that are like that. So, the process of bhakti in the transformation of mind is very interesting. The process of bhakti is the process of filling your heart with love and molding the mind. And really speaking, all selfish thoughts that are distorting the mind are based on ego, based on that conception, right? That rather than be the servant of God and others, to be the controller and master of everyone. That's the root of all the selfish vrittis in the mind. So in the process of bhakti, what you do is you fill your heart with love and devotion. And what happens is it changes the mind from inside out. Because the process of yoga, which is this, you work on the mind. It's very interesting. You work on the mind, and when the mind becomes lucid and clear, you can see the soul. Bhakti works on the soul to change the mind. When you actually work on the soul, the nature of the soul to love, it automatically molds the mind to a higher level of perception. So bhakti is a little bit of a different psychology in that way. And when you chant mantras, what happens is mantras, which signify the divine, objects, and every object has a shakti or potency. Objects and acts of devotion have the potency to put love in your heart. So when you meditate and focus on mantras, the shakti of love enters, it touches your soul, and the energy of the soul comes and molds your mind. So there's different ways that we deal with it. But it's such a fascinating thing. I had a birthday last year, and someone gave me a gift. Let's see if I can find it. It's my calling card, by the way. And if anybody wants, do I have that there? Yeah, maybe I do. No. Otherwise, you can write it down. Okay. It must be someplace here. I feel it. That's another thing. I hope I have it. I do. I want to use them, right? I got them. Okay. So what we can do, any other questions? We do have 5 more minutes. So we'll do some bhakti meditation, okay? For 5 minutes. I'll put away all my samskaras. I'll put away my mind.
What's the name of that mountain where you went for meditation?
Govardhan. Govardhan. Okay. You ready? Sit up. Or as comfortably as you can. If your feet have to be out, there's no problem. So in this meditation, what you do is 2 things. You'll hear the mantra, and because the expression is the same of what is expressed in terms of mantra, it is the divine. So what you do is you just feel the vibration of the mantra as I chant it. And then you chant it in response, and it becomes a prayer. And it's a prayer to make your heart selfless and loving. And you listen carefully to the voice of the mantra. You listen to the sincerity of your chanting. So first you feel the mantra. Feel that communion with God. Try to feel what you feel for the mantra in the relationship of your soul. And then you chant and listen to the sincerity of your mantra. Okay? So first I'll chant. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna.
Krishna, Krishna, Hare. Thank you.
Meditation means other thoughts may come, but you don't follow those thoughts. You just concentrate on the object of your meditation, and you give your heart to the object of meditation with no other thoughts. And if you do this, it actually becomes yoga, and the mind becomes molded to a higher level of perception and contentment. So we'll just chant for 2 or 3 more minutes and really be determined to relax and don't follow any other thoughts except the mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Distinguish between that nature of the soul, that energy of the soul, and the mind, which is based on the ego, which is all the selfish thoughts. And you just stay in that space. And keep, by staying in that space, the lens of the mind will become clearer and clearer. And then when you gradually open your eyes, you can see through the mood of service, the mood of selflessness and devotion and love. Okay? You can gradually open your minds.